Welcome to Legal Lens, a DebtWire podcast on legal issues impacting restructuring and the distressed industry at large. My name is Andy Serby. Today, I'm glad to be joined by Andrew Gallo of Morgan Lewis, a partner in their restructuring and bankruptcy Boston office, specializing in bankruptcy litigation. Some of his engagements include representing the unsecured private placement notes holders in Ultra Petroleum, acting as lead counsel to the UCCs in cases including Covia and White Star Petroleum, and representing the court-appointed receiver in Whitaker, Clark, and Daniels bankruptcy, just to name a selection. Andrew, welcome to the show.
Thank you, Andy. Great to be here.
So first, let's start off with a little bit about you, and then we'll kind of dig into the topic today, which is PERTs and make-wholes. So can you tell us a little bit about your background and kind of how you got into the bankruptcy practice and then into Morgan Lewis?
Well, I graduated from Penn Law in 98. I was a clerk for Judge Stein, Sidney Stein, who's still a senior judge in the Southern District of New York. And my first legal job was at Bingham, the Bingham Dana firm in Boston. I came in as a litigator. I was working one Saturday and one of my fellow associates poked her head into my office and said, "Hey, are you busy?" Which obviously I would have been because I was in the office on a Saturday. But they had a bankruptcy case, like most bankruptcy cases, that was in extremis and had an emergency, and they were really in need of an associate to help on a litigation-related issue in a bankruptcy. That was in my second year at the firm, and I've been doing bankruptcy ever since. So I switched over from the litigation practice to the bankruptcy practice when I was at Bingham. Bingham Dana became Bingham McCutcheon. And then in 2014, Bingham McCutcheon combined with Morgan Lewis. So I've been at Morgan Lewis in the bankruptcy group here since 2014. And I do all kinds of bankruptcy law. I do both in-court and out-of-court bankruptcy workouts, et cetera. But given my, you know, litigation background, my specialty is in the contentious areas of bankruptcy and in things that face a court. I've litigated all sorts of adversary proceedings, fraudulent transfer, defense, lender liability cases. I have also litigated inside Chapter 11 cases, confirmation disputes like we had in the Ultra case, valuation disputes, et cetera. And that's really my specialty is bankruptcy and bankruptcy related litigation that arise out of insolvent entities.
Right. And the topic today is certainly something that's given rise to some very hard fought litigation. Getting into the Hertz topic, you obviously can't discuss this decision without talking about the solvent debtor exception. So by way of background, could you tell us a little bit about kind of the background of the solvent debtor exception and the potential appellate and like the appellate law up to the point of Hertz? And then we'll kind of dig into that decision itself.
The Ultra case, obviously, if you're interested in the solvent debtor exception and the history of the solvent debtor exception, Ultra is a great read for you because it'll take you all the way back to England and the solvent debtor exception as imposed under English law, which was essentially the basic concept of the solvent debtor exception is that when an entity is solvent, even though it may avail itself of bankruptcy laws or back then insolvency laws, if the entity ends up being solvent, it has to pay its creditors what they're owed in full under its contracts with those creditors before the debtor or equity of the debtor can retain any excess surplus. And that was the rule under common law in England. That was the rule under the bankruptcy acts that preceded the bankruptcy code. And then the bankruptcy code was enacted. And the bankruptcy code, which we operate under now, contains a very clear prohibition in section 502(b)(2) of the code, which prohibits the payment of unmatured interest. And so what we're seeing in the recent solvent debtor cases, as I call them, those being Ultra, PG&E, and then ultimately Hertz, is the intersection of those two concepts. The codification of in section 502(b)(2) of disallowing the payment of unmatured interest to creditors in a Chapter 11 case as it comes against this ancient common law rule, which provides for the payment of a full claim, including interest up through the date of payment where the debtor is solvent. And so that's the intersection that you're seeing now. And it just so happens that within the past 4 years, you know, since the Ultra case was decided or initially decided, and then subsequently you've got PG&E and Hertz, you have these very high profile cases involving solvent debtors, which you usually don't have because it's rare to have a solvent entity in bankruptcy. And that has set the stage for the courts to rule on this issue, the showdown between Section 502B2 and the solvent debtor exception, if you will.
We absolutely love a legal showdown on this show. Getting into Hertz specifically, as someone who's kind of really tracked this issue, did the result come as a surprise at all to you, or were there specific elements of it that maybe kind of stood out to you when you read it?
Well, I wouldn't say it was a surprise, because given that you've had two other circuit courts coming down the same way, the Fifth Circuit in Ultra and the Ninth Circuit in PG&E, it's hard to call it a surprise. But I was certainly curious to see what the Third Circuit would do. And there's really two aspects of these cases, particularly Ultra and Hertz, which involved both make-whole and the solvent debtor exception, whereas PG&E involved simply the payment of interest. There was no make-whole there. And the first aspect of these cases, these being Ultra and Hertz, is the decision as to whether or not make-whole, this make-whole formula that you find in many bonds, is itself unmatured interest, and then whether or not unmatured interest, including make-whole and regular post-petition interest paid at the default rate, can be paid in solvent debtor cases. The first question was one that I was very interested in seeing where the Third Circuit would come out, because in lower courts in the Third Circuit that have decided the issue of whether or not make-whole constitutes interest have held that it doesn't. There's cases in lower courts in the Third Circuit where they labeled make-whole as liquidated damages as opposed to unmatured interest. It was curious to see whether the Third Circuit would uphold that lower court precedent, or whether it would side the same way that the court did in Ultra to find make-whole was unmatured interest. And it did, unfortunately for those people who like make-wholes, the Third Circuit did rule the same way that the Fifth Circuit ruled in Ultra, finding that the make-whole is the economic equivalent of unmatured interest. I would say what surprised me about the decision was the breadth to which the Third Circuit went in finding the make-whole to be unmatured interest. In Ultra, the Fifth Circuit's decision was grounded in the fact that the formula used was a basically discounted back future interest. So interest was a significant part of the formula. And at least if you can read that decision and come away saying that if you've got a make-whole that isn't based upon or isn't calculated using future interest payments, it may not fit within the Fifth Circuit's definition of unmatured interest, because the Fifth Circuit deemed the fact that interest was a part of the formula to be significant in finding the make-whole to be unmatured interest. The Third Circuit didn't ground itself in finding that a make-whole is unmatured interest because interest is part of the formula. It basically found that any fee, no matter how calculated, and they say it in a decision, whether it's a dollar or whether it's $1 billion, any fee that is not matured as of the petition date is the economic equivalent of unmatured interest, because it is compensation that was negotiated by the lender at the beginning of the loan in exchange for the use of its funds. That makes it the economic equivalent. So the Hertz decision is actually broader in that any make-whole fee, or whether you want to call it a repayment fee or anything like that, constitutes unmatured interest regardless of how it's calculated and whether or not interest is even a component of the fee.
Right. We talked a little bit about why Hertz and Ultra kind of stand out. And even beyond the specific terms of the payments and the decisions, they're both born of kind of unique circumstances. Like, I'm curious, when we talk about Hertz, it's the story of the COVID rebound, things reopening, and the company, without changing all that much about the way it operated, the company's business just kind of like revitalized naturally as the world broadly reopened.
Yeah, oil prices specifically there. Yeah, oil and gas.
I'm curious whether they are more tied together because in the broadest sense, they're both the product of a solvent debtor because of a rebound in prices, whether Hertz's circumstances also make it stand out a little bit, because at least hopefully we don't have to endure anything kind of like that phenomenon for a very long time. So it's just, I have a hard time seeing a case like Hertz happening again, but maybe close-ish, like something like Ultra, like a more natural, for lack of a better word, asset rebound.
Yeah, I mean, I think you're identifying something that I spoke about earlier, which is the very unique case of a solvent debtor. So the reason why we've had 502b2 in the code for decades and the solvent debtor rule has been around for decades and you haven't seen this clash that we're talking about today, we've seen it in some other cases, but it hasn't been directly addressed like this, is because of the fact that it's so rare to get a solvent debtor. And here you have three major significant circuit court cases involving solvent debtors. And they're all for the very unique reasons. Like you said, Ultra filed in 2016 and was the result of a precipitous drop in oil and gas prices. As gas prices rebounded post-petition, Ultra became solvent. PG&E was very specifically the result of the wildfires. It was a otherwise healthy business that had this significant exposure because of the wildfires. Once that wildfire litigation was resolved, it was solvent. And then Hertz was very, as you said, very specific as to COVID, and then became solvent after it filed. You know, you had these unique circumstances in each case that resulted in having major, otherwise financially viable entities become insolvent, file for bankruptcy, and then ultimately become solvent again. The other thing I will say, though, is that another significant difference between the ruling in the Hertz case and the ruling in the Ultra case, the Ultra ruling that permitted payment of make-whole and unmatured interest in that case was very specifically based on the solvent debtor exception. They said explicitly, this is the solvent debtor exception. It existed pre-bankruptcy code and it survived the bankruptcy code. And that's the basis for our ruling today. In Hertz, the Second Circuit didn't rely as directly on the solvent debtor exception. What the Second Circuit relied on in Hertz was the absolute priority rule. And it said the absolute priority rule, based upon the Supreme Court's decision in Jevic, is a rule, a fundamental right in bankruptcy that applies to all creditors, be they impaired, be they unimpaired, and it applies in every situation. And so that, therefore, as a result, any plan that purports to leave a creditor unimpaired, but then provides distributions to equity without paying that unimpaired creditor the full amount of what it's due under a contract, will be deemed invalid and to violate the absolute priority rule. Why that's significant is that if the absolute priority rule applies in every case, then that same logic can be used in cases that are not, do not involve solvent debtors. And if you have an insolvent case where you've got unimpaired creditors, but you have junior creditors receiving value, that same ruling in the Hertz case would allow those unimpaired creditors to argue, this violates Hertz. You know, I am not getting the full value of my claim. You have not rendered me unimpaired, and there are junior creditors to me, even though the debtor is insolvent, getting paid before I am. So arguably, the Hertz decision would apply more broadly in cases that don't involve solvent debtors. And it'll be interesting to see if that matters at all, and if so, how it plays out in future cases.
Just kind of off the cuff, part of me wonders if that played any role in the decision in the now confirmed FTX plan, where they were paying people back with whatever, 118% plus interest. Like, I do wonder if they were thinking about this at all.
There's complicated issues involved in FTX in terms of how do you value crypto? Is it a claim? Like, when does that claim calculated? That are different than the issues here. But at its core, you do have an absolute priority issue, which is you can't pay anyone junior until you pay everyone senior what they're entitled to under their existing agreements. So I would agree with you that may have had some impact.
So we kind of already dug into the next section, which is kind of where we like to crack out our crystal ball and see how the effects is. But we've just been talking about kind of the downstream effects of the Hertz decision in terms of like the breadth of the decision and how it can be applied, maybe even outside of solvent debtors. What I'm also curious about is, since these opinions all at face value, they might agree, quote unquote, I'm curious if there's a road to the Supreme Court for this issue that you could see happening, or really any kind of like higher court potential for a dispute down the road?
That's a good question. You know, typically the Supreme Court won't get involved unless you've got a circuit split. And here you've got the opposite of circuit split. You've got the only three circuit courts who have ruled on this have ruled the same, that the solvent debtor exception survives the code, and that where you have a solvent debtor, they have to pay, you know, full contract rate interest, not interest, post-petition interest calculated at the federal judgment rate. Now, it's possible, you know, this court is seen as a very textualist court, and you can view these decisions as, there's one way to view these decisions is they place policy over the text of the code. Certainly, that's what the dissenting judges felt in both Ultra and in the Hertz decision, where each of the dissenting judges found that the bankruptcy code 502b2 is a clear prohibition on the payment of interest, and that should override any extra textual solvent debtor exception, or in the Third Circuit's case, absolute priority rule. In that sense, you know, could the Supreme Court take this up? Potentially, although cert was denied in PG&E and in Ultra. And so it remains to be seen whether it would be granted in Hertz, where that case came out the same way.
Right. I believe the most recent development there was they requested en banc rehearing.
By the entire Third Circuit.
Yeah.
In Hertz. Yeah. And which is what happened in Ultra, too.
So kind of wrapping things up here, really the other question is, when we look at the kind of the expanded breadth of the Hertz decision, how it can be applied versus other cases, make-whole payments are kind of like an important part of the lending market. And I wonder if you think that there will be any sort of development in those markets, or maybe a change to the way that credit agreements are drafted from like maybe companies that are trying to protect against this kind of stuff? Or is there anything that they can really do? Or do they just have to bake in this risk when they take on bonds?
We saw this post Ultra, which is that, you know, many people in the credit market, particularly the fixed instruments or the private placement market, where these types of make-whole formulas are most common, went back to the drawing board and tried to see if they could draft a similar type of prepayment provision or make-whole provision that would not be invalidated by Ultra, primarily one that either matures prior to bankruptcy, which would also protect it from the decision in Hertz as well, or one that wasn't based on interest payments, which would protect it from the ruling in Ultra, but not necessarily for the ruling in Hertz. So I do think that people are going to be looking at this more closely. One way to try to figure this out is to try to make payments that mature prior to bankruptcy so that they're not unmatured when bankruptcy strikes. There's going to be less ability after Hertz, particularly in the Third Circuit anyway, to fix make holes by making them based on something other than interest, because Hertz seemed to suggest that no matter what they're based on, they're invalid. It may be that this just gets priced into the market and, you know, borrowing becomes more expensive because you can't have these make holes. I think that's all going to play out. I think the Hertz decision, like the Ultra decision, is something that the market is looking at and will be something that people consider going forward, most certainly.
Absolutely. And we'll both be keeping a close eye on it moving forward, I'm sure.
Yes, absolutely.
Andrew, it's been a pleasure talking today. Thanks for taking the time to share your thoughts and your expertise with us on this complex, really interesting decision.
My pleasure, Andy. It was great to talk to you too.
And thank you, as always, to our listeners for checking out this episode of Legal Lens. We'll see you next time.